Hello, it's Friday, June the 4th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. 50 Shades of Grey, oh my word, yet another book is out, and we've got Jan Moyer to review it. Vegans, a study shows children who eat vegan food could grow up with far more brittle bones. Care homes, is that awful Dominic Cummings right? Well, certainly the poll by Savanta Comrades says most people think the government didn't do enough to prevent the COVID pandemic ripping through our care homes. But first, it's chaos, isn't it? Especially if you're in Portugal and you're now trying to get back. We're going to tell you how much the average airline ticket is one way from the Algarve back to Britain. Seats on the last flights back to London from the Algarve have gone on sale for up to £711 today as Britons face a race to get back. This comes after Portugal was removed from the UK's green list yesterday, meaning in less than 4 days' time, those returning will have to isolate for up to 10 days. Many travellers have been left in limbo over to go ahead with their holidays. Joining us to try to make sense of it all is consumer expert and travel broadcaster Adrian Mills. Adrian, I suppose on the one hand, we all know if we travel abroad, the chances are the status on the traffic light system could change. But that came out of nowhere, didn't it, Portugal?
Yes, it did. I was talking to people literally just a couple of days ago, and people working in the holiday industry, and they were all saying, we're very excited because Mallorca, Ibiza, the Balearics, Monaco, Malta, they're all going to go into the green list. And I said at the time, don't be surprised if the government are going to be very cautious about this. I did not expect nothing to go onto the green list. And of course, what makes this even more bizarre, it's only a week ago that we allowed thousands and thousands of football supporters from the UK to travel to Porto. And now here we are going, right, Portugal, take that off the list. I actually feel it's really, really disingenuous of Grant Shapps to actually be saying, well, you know, we've got to react. We have to, if there's a variant. When you listen to the Portuguese tourist minister, he says, but hang on a minute. Our infection rate is probably slightly less than the UK. We're all social distancing. We are wearing masks. And we advise people very clearly on our websites what how to behave. So they are at a complete and utter loss. And do not forget, though, that Boris Johnson only literally a couple of weeks ago said, I will have no hesitation to move countries off the green list. He made no mention of taking countries off the amber or the red list. So maybe we should have seen this coming.
And I see, because, of course, seven countries, amber countries, went red. I've suspected for a long time, Adrian, and I don't know what you hear from the people you talk to in the travel industry. I thought for a long time they just don't want us to go abroad for two reasons. They're terrified of importing variants because of this, they screwed up, and they know they screwed up over the amount of time it took to put India on the red list. But also they want people to spend the money here.
Well, yes, they do. But what you've got to remember as well is that we are so dependent as a country on tourists coming to here. What we're sort of sending out is actually we're not letting anyone out of the country. And if you're coming here, you will have to probably go into self-isolation as well. So we're actually killing off our inbound holiday makers. But this, you know, as I keep saying to everybody, if this was just related to the UK, you could understand. But it is a global issue. And I thought it was significant. I noticed yesterday that there was a big announcement. You know, the Euros are going ahead. The Olympics are going ahead. All sorts of massive sporting events around the world. And yet I noticed in Japan, in Tokyo, I mean, we were so dependent on the volunteers that helped in London 2012. Out of 80,000 volunteers in Japan, in the last month, 10,000 have resigned, saying they will not be volunteering because they're terrified of allowing people into the country. And that is the problem. You may well be vaccinated, but we still, to this day, and they won't admit it, they still won't admit that actually, can you still pick up an infection and not realize? And because those variants keep changing all over the world, that, as you so rightly say, they do not want the slightest hint of anything getting onto the UK shores.
And yet we know, don't we, Adrian, because we're not experts, but we've all read enough now about this wretched pandemic to know there are going to be new variants all the time. The current latest one is Nepal. I hear there's one from in Vietnam, another one in Thailand. We've got our own Kent variant. We've got to get used to these variants and learn to live with them. And of course, if you look at our hospital, our infection rates, while they're up here, hospitalizations are not up dramatically and the death rate is currently lower than you'd expect probably from flu.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have said to me, okay, you know, if I can't go to Europe, can I go further afield? And you just mentioned a couple of the Asian countries there, and we have a family business out in Thailand. Now, if you think the UK, what, 5% vaccinated? Thailand only has a vaccination rate at this very moment in time of 3%. And I think the last time I spoke to you some months ago, they'd only had 90 deaths in a year. Well, since that time, they've now had 1,100 deaths in a matter of months. Because they're now going through a third wave and they're terrified. So all those countries, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Indonesia, have gone on to, or are on that red list. Interesting enough, the Thai Tourist Authority have introduced something that if you can prove that you've been vaccinated and had both your vaccinations and you wish to go to Thailand, they've introduced something called the sandbox, where you can fly to Phuket and you can do whatever you want in Phuket. And that means leave your hotel as well. You're not isolating there. But you can't leave the area, that specific area of Phuket, for 7 days. After that, you're free to travel around the country. But I suspect, yet again, that will change as the variants change. But we are, as you so rightly say, at a point where at what point do we say we are going to have to live with this? We have to live our lives. We can't lock ourselves away forever. But it's everybody looking over their shoulders. And the holiday industry is saying at the moment, there are more flights being cancelled than are being booked. So, you know, when will this end? I said 6 months ago, don't think about booking anything in the near future. And I think I would suggest you ain't booking anything really probably until 2022 to be on the safe side.
Advice, Adrian, and it's advice I'm certainly going to take. That's Adrian Mills, consumer expert and travel broadcaster. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Nearly two-thirds of UK adults say the government didn't do enough to protect care homes from the coronavirus at the start of the pandemic. This includes 3 in 5 Conservative voters and almost three-quarters of those aged over 55. Plus half of those polled think the government prioritised the economy more than saving lives at the start of the pandemic. So what should we make of this? Chris Hopkins, Associate Director of Savantacom Res, can give us some idea. Chris, I'm not surprised really. I think everybody knows some of the mistakes that were made right at the beginning of this included hospitals releasing people into care homes without them being tested first for the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, these figures aren't much of a surprise, as you say. And I think, you know, looking ahead to 2022, I would imagine that this particular mistake is going to be quite the focus of any public inquiry that does take place. And I think, you know, overall, the government are still riding a bit of a crest of a wave because of the success of the vaccination rollout and the success of the programme. But I think they're not out of the woods completely yet. I think when things like this do get highlighted, and they will continue to get highlighted over the next few years, I think the public haven't completely forgotten about what happened in 2020, despite the positivity this side of Christmas.
Matt Hancock, the health secretary, of course, is going before a select committee of MPs, similar to the way Dominic Cummings did. We're told he's ordered a complete timeline of every decision that was taken about care homes. This poll will reinforce his wish to make sure he's got every single piece of information at his disposal so he can fight off the inevitable criticism that will face him in that hearing from MPs. And there'll be Conservative MPs criticising too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's going to get it from all angles, really, and you know, rightly so. I think, as I say, the public haven't forgotten what happened at the start of the pandemic in 2020, and the good news this year has papered over some of the cracks. But I think, you know, these cracks are going to reappear. How much public cut through select committee hearings have remains to be seen. You know, I'm not convinced that even Cummings' appearance in the last week or so really had that much cut through. But yeah, you know, when the inquiry kicks off, I do think that the public will start to sit up and take notice, and yeah, you know, the Conservatives can enjoy you know, good poll ratings at the moment, but they may not last forever, particularly when you know, voters are reminded of the mistakes that were made in 2020.
And you sort of sense, Chris, if there is to be a scapegoat out of the things that would went wrong, nobody's perfect. All governments around the world struggled with the scale of the pandemic. But you do wonder if this is the fact, if this is the one thing the public really find it very difficult to forgive the government for, if it will be Matt Hancock's head offered up on a plate, John the Baptist like, to say, well, he's been fired in the reshuffle. We listen to the public, and it does feel a bit like that.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think on the whole, you know, he hasn't had a terrible pandemic. He's a fairly good communicator, but obviously there have been mistakes made, and there does seem to be some impression that he, you know, has lied kind of throughout the pandemic, and you know, whether that's about the availability of PPE or decision making, you know, when it comes to care homes. You know, ultimately, if mistakes did end up costing lives, and that seemed to be what Dominic Cummings implied last week, then yeah, there will have to be some culpability for that. And yeah, I would imagine that it is going to be Hancock that perhaps it is offered up. You know, it's unlikely to be the Prime Minister. And then I guess the other you know, major player in all of this, Rishi Sunak, from an economic point of view, you know, did many more positive things, and it's going to be difficult to kind of hold him responsible for any kind of loss of life. So yeah, you know, I think that Hancock could end up being the scapegoat, but you know, alternatively, there are considerably fewer resignations, you know, in any kind of government now than there were, you know, say 10, 15, 20 years ago. So yeah, I'm sure all parties will be trying to cling on for as long as they can. But yeah, you know, I think Hancock's position possibly is the most perilous.
Very interesting. That's Chris Hopkins. He's the Associate Director of Savanta Comres. Thanks for joining us. And a little bit of breaking news. Straight after I talked to Chris Hopkins from Savanta Comres, a new opinion poll dropped from YouGov, which has given the Conservatives, believe it or not, a 16-point lead, up even higher from before Dominic Cummings. So if that's the case, it appears that the public simply didn't believe Dominic Cummings, because they didn't believe him over his trip to Barnard Castle a year ago when he said he was getting his eyes tested. Perhaps they didn't believe what he said about the government's performance. Who knows? A study by University College London shows that vegan children grow up shorter and have weaker bones than those who eat meat. Now, apparently children on plant-based diets are on average just over an inch shorter than omnivores. A nationwide study in 2019 found as many as 10% of children aged 8 to 16 now identify as vegetarian or vegan. We have nutritionist Monica Price with us. Monica, what do you make of this? And is this a setback for the vegan brigade? Because, of course, they've been making big strides forward, more people going vegan. And as we see, lots more young people on vegan diets.
Yes, absolutely. What's happening is veganism is actually quadruple now in the UK and in the world. People are looking at different various reasons, climate change, of course, just own varied tastes. People want a more plant-based diet. But what this study shows, Andrew, is that we actually need more studies like this, because whilst this was a study and it was a really good study, it's a small study. So what we need to do is have research like this to actually identify what is happening and why children aren't getting the nutrients that they need. Children's bodies are developing all the time, so it's vital that they have all the right nutrients that they need to make a healthy body. The problems that can happen with a vegan diet is if you don't fully understand the vegan diet, or you haven't sort of taken the time to understand what foods contain the right vitamins and minerals that the child needs, that's where you can fall into some problems. Most parents who are vegan, who are wanting to have their child vegan, will have a full understanding of what this entails. And it was interesting, Andrew, that vitamin B12 was one of the vitamins that was highlighted in this study, because that is absolutely vital. It's one of those very, very, very important vitamins that your body needs. It needs it for your nervous system to function properly. It turns food into energy, so it gives the child lots of energy. It, you know, creates new cells so that they can grow. It forms their blood cells. So it's a very, very important vitamin. And that's one that's often lacking in the vegan diet.
And of course, if they do, and I appreciate this is a small study, Monica, yes, but if they do grow up with smaller, weaker bones, young people, aren't they in later life at risk of fractures or even possibly worse, osteoporosis, which can be deeply, really uncomfortable? Well, it's an appalling condition. Camilla Parker Bowles' yes, mother famously had it.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Andrew. It's really, really important that anybody that's wanting to either go vegan or is considering it or is already vegan, that they look at what they're actually eating. It's very easy to just go into the supermarkets now because vegans become so popular. Obviously, the food manufacturers are now producing much more ready-produced, ready-to-eat meals, which, of course, often contain lots of fat, sugar and salt, just like our meals would if you were an omnivore. So it's really important that it's particularly with children that you engage with the veganism, if you like, and have a really understanding of what it is and what you should be eating. You can't just eat, you know, ready meals all the time. It is a plant-based diet. So if you're going for this diet, you have to make sure, for instance, that calcium, which is commonly found with children when they eat, of course, lots of dairy products, you can't eat that as a vegan. So you have to look for other forms of food. So it's really ensuring that you're either having foods that are fortified, so in other words, foods that have had these vitamins added to it, or you're eating lots and lots of green leafy vegetables, for instance, because that contains lots of calcium and iron as well.
And would you be suggesting as well, Monica, that people take vitamin supplements just in case? You mentioned that vitamin earlier, B32. Vitamin D, I gather, is it B32 or is it B12 you mentioned?
B12.
And also, can't some vegan diets also lack vitamin D?
Yes, you're right, Andrew. What should be happening is for children in particular, if you're unsure of the diet, first of all, there's plenty of research. You can go online now. There's so many places that you can go to find out about a veganism. Babies in particular, of course, so under 6 months, they just need a very small amount of, for instance, like B12, 0.4 micrograms they need. So they should get that sufficiently, either from the breast milk or vegan baby formula, which is now available, or of course, any soya formula. But from 6 months, when they're starting perhaps to wean onto food, that could be a time where you could consider giving them vitamin B12, because it's very common to be deficient in B12 with vegans of any age. So that's the one vitamin that you should be really keeping an eye on. And of course, the same, you can get vitamins now, multivitamins for children. So from about 6 months old, that would be a good thing particularly if you were unsure of the diet and you weren't perhaps having a full understanding of what's required of this vegan diet.
And Monica, some parents seeing this study, I appreciate, again, it is a small study, might panic yes, a little and think, that's it. They say to their child, you've got to have some red meat once a week, which could cause quite a confrontation with the child, particularly if they're a teenager. What's your advice to those parents?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. This is such a personal thing. Veganism has become such a trendy thing as well, Andrew, and that's the thing I don't like, you know, because children should not be treated as a trend. You know, children have got very complex needs. And when you go into the teenage years as well, they've got very, very complex needs. You know, their appetite, it goes wild. They'll need far, far more calories than ever before. So again, all I could stress is that it's really important that you get some help, get some advice, do your own research, have a really good understanding of what foods you should be eating, particularly for teenagers. And really listen to the child. You know, children now, as young as sort of 5 or 6, are coming home to their parents and saying, I don't want to eat meat anymore. So you have to sit down with your child and really have an understanding of why they're doing that, you know, because they're still, at the end of the day, children. And by law, until they're 18 years old, you as an adult, you as a parent have got to guide them the best way you can. So it's really difficult. It's a really difficult topic. But I think if you communicate with your child, have an understanding about what they need to eat. And then, of course, you know, you've got to be really careful yourself as an adult, because you could have, you know, you could be eating meat, but perhaps your child wants to turn vegan, for example. So you need to then really do have an understanding of what that food should be prepared for that child. So in other words, lots of vegetables, lots of plant-based, lots of fruit. This is the sort of diet that is required. And that is why it's so easy sometimes to have those vitamins become deficient, because it's just impossible to eat, you know, platefuls and platefuls of green leafy vegetables, that's where a supplement can be very, very useful.
That's the nutritionist, Monica Price. Visit melplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at melplus or me at toryboypierce. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatt was here with the latest sports news. I was going to ask you, Matt, is it uphill in the Test match at Lord's? But rain is winning, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good to have a traditional English summer back, cricket back, and the rain falling and the covers on. So after the first 2 days where we had, certainly on day one, we had glorious sunshine, this day so far has been a washout. So there's not been a ball bowled, which is a shame, because the Test match was beautifully poised after New Zealand had got off to a very good start on day one, and England fought back on day two yesterday, and you know, we're 200 behind, and the Test match was nicely poised. Now the forecast for Saturday and Sunday is still good, so we may still see a conclusion to this first Test match between England and New Zealand. So all is not lost. You can still get some chance to see some cricket tomorrow.
And we've got more Europe. We've got another curtain raiser, don't we, coming up, Matt, before the European Football Championships. But sadly, yeah, more England players injured.
Yeah, I mean, so Trent Alexander-Arnold, the Liverpool fullback, had to pull out of the squad yesterday. So, you know, that's a blow for Southgate and for the England team. Now, he may not have been an actual starter, so they could probably cope with that setback. But maybe even more worrying is the fact that Jordan Henderson, one of the key midfielders, now he's pretty much been ruled out of the opening game by Southgate. Now, he may play at the weekend, as you say, in this final warm-up game, which is against Romania. But he won't have kicked a ball in anger if he plays this Sunday since February. So that'll be the first time he's played. So to think that he might be ready for the opener the following weekend against Croatia is probably fanciful. And that's what Southgate pretty much said yesterday, that he hasn't played enough football. So, you know, you can almost see him missing the entire group stage as well. Harry Maguire, again, the key centre-half, he doesn't look like he is going to feature possibly even in the whole group stage as well. So you're looking at two very key players that Southgate won't have available to him. The good thing is he's got lots of youngsters flying at the moment, so he can turn to them. Saka played very well, the young Arsenal kid the other night. Bellingham played really well in central midfield in the Henderson position. So he's got options. He's got youngsters to turn to. And he's going to have to hope that the kids are all right, because he looks like he might have to rely on them.
Maybe I just don't get football, and I know the answer is no, you don't. But why bother playing these warm-up matches, which could just subject even more players who might be crucial to injury, Matt?
Well, I see your point. I guess it's just, you know, fine-tuning, and he may want to work on certain tactical plans within those right. 11 players, because obviously, you know, I know what you mean, certainly about someone like, you know, I don't know, let's take Harry Kane, for example, who we all know he's going to score lots of goals if he's played up front. But the way he plays with Tottenham, he drops off into the midfield a little bit to collect the ball. Now, Gareth Southgate might want to get him out there and say, look, I don't want you to do what you do for Tottenham. I want you to run in behind the defenders rather than drop off. Or little tactical tweaks which go above your head and go above my head. But for these Southgate and his coaches, they might be quite important. So there is some fine-tuning to be done, and there is some certain relationships to be built up on the pitch. You can't just chuck 11 players out there who haven't played together for a while and hope that it all clicks. So they are useful, although, frankly, from an England point of view, because of the fact that the club players have gone so deep into the season with the Champions League final and the Europa League final, they've barely had any chance to play together anyway. So this Sunday, he'll have his Chelsea, Man U and Man City players back. And that will be their one warm-up game, then a week's training, and then the first game. So, you know, they barely have played in these warm-ups anyway.
Very interesting. And when you say Matt goes over your head, all of it goes over my head, the lot.
We're getting there, aren't we? Some of it's sinking.
We're trying. As people say, yeah, I'm always very trying. That's the Deputy Sports Editor, Matt Gatwood, with the latest. And we'll be keeping you up to date, of course, on the Test match here on Mail Plus.
Literary snobs look away or even listen away because E.L. James, the author of the 50 Shades series, she's put down, as my colleague Jan Moyer put it, her throbbing pen for good. Freed, the last chapter in the six-book series, was released this week. 50 Shades, you know all about it. The series has been incredibly popular, so popular it's been translated into 52 languages and been made into three Hollywood films, and only J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame has sold more books than E.L. James. Daily Mail columnist Jan Moyer wrote an hilarious piece about the book. And you start like this, Jan. Yes, 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 yes. Ignore my panting exultations. It really is rubbish prose, isn't it? But it's a great seller.
Well, I mean, the literary world does look down on E.L. James. And I don't know how she feels about that, actually. But I do think that whatever you can say about her, she's written six books that have really resonated with women. She's really connected with women all over the world, and they can't get enough of her panting exultations and her, you know, trussed-up throbbings of her two heroes, Christian Grey and Anastasia Steele, who meet, marry, tie each other up a lot, and then get married in the end, and they all live happily ever after. But, you know, I mean, what she did was she wrote three books from Anastasia's point of view, and then in a really clever bit of housekeeping, she wrote the next three books with exactly the same plot from his point of view. So, I mean, even E.L. James has reached the end of the line now. It can't go on any longer, Andrew.
Yeah, and she's, you say she yet again created a carnal but corny world in which characters are wound up tighter than an old-fashioned watch and arousal is measured by tongues that greet each other in every language.
That's right. I mean, some of the analogies that she uses, I mean, she's like a sort of woman who's sort of like an alien who's never spoken English before. I mean, if I'm allowed to kind of say, am I allowed to talk about... She talks about nipples being aroused by lengthening, and sometimes they even pebble. I mean, it's just awful, but, you know.
But why? So it's women who buy these books, presumably, because I've read a few pages of E.L. James, and I just
have
was
you, Andrew?
Whooping with laughter because I thought it was so corny. And I couldn't believe, virtually on the first page, we were straight into it.
That's right.
Straight away.
In the new book, yes. Well, the thing is, you know, Andrew, if you knew your 50 Shades of Grey, you would know that he had just proposed to her and she had said yes, and they were having an engagement party, which of course they had to sneak away from to have a kind of a little illicit bit of, you know,
more sex.
Well, yes, rumpy pumpy, whatever you want to call it. So they'd gone down to the boathouse, and the book opens there with them in a sort of blissed out in a post-coital moment.
I love this bit. Paged 425, the lamb chops from the Greek deli were transferred into a Pyrex bowl at the exact moment when his lust surges like a tidal wave south. South, not north, or east,
no.
Or west?
Well, I don't know where lust starts, you know. I mean, she seems to. Well, I mean, this is the thing. She's written this book from a male point of view, from his point of view. And every now and again, you find that a little bit jarring. I mean, would an aroused male character really pause to note what the dish was made of, that it was made of Pyrex? I mean, there's a gratifying amount of detail about how beautiful he finds Anastasia's hair. I mean, it's always described as wild and glossy in the morning light, and later it tumbles around us, like creating a beautiful chestnut haven. I mean, this is what women want to hear. We want to know that all the time and effort we have spent on making our hair look nice
is appreciated,
that men aren't just looking at cleavages or whatever. They're thinking, wow, look at the glossy shine on her hair.
And what do you think E.L. James will do I was going to say, as the climax of her literary career. Will she write another book? I mean, she's made so much money. Why does she care what the critics think?
Well, and I hope she takes great comfort from that because, you know, hers is a great achievement, even if you sort of don't approve of her books or don't think they have literary merit. I mean, she has written, she has deviated from the 50 Shades book. In 2019, she wrote a novel called The Mister, which was equally hilarious. It featured a Cornish aristocrat. Andrew, I know you're not going to believe this, but he was really, really handsome.
No.
And he fell in love with his demure but beautiful Albanian cleaning lady.
Oh.
It was really
modern
lovely.
Modern take on Podarc.
Exactly. And equally, like Christian Grey, he had a winning way with woman. And in one paragraph he says, "As you wish, I growl and thrust inside her." So, I mean, so we're carrying on in the same vein. What is she going to do? I hope she sort of retires and really enjoys her money. I mean, she's a multi-mansioned woman, as you might expect. Mm. She's got a beautiful property down in Cornwall. She's got a lovely London home. I mean, she's built up this amazing fortune all by herself. All credit to her.
I agree. I don't feel I need to read it, having read your fabulous review, Jan Moir. And that's Jan Moir, of course. And don't forget, she'll have her equally fabulous column in the Daily Mail.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce, albeit with a heavy cold, as you can probably tell. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.